It's now time for us to go on to the next of these prophetic witnesses. And this is a direct prophecy, this time, not a parallel as some of the others have been, although Matthew 22 wasn't entirely a parallel because it was a direct prophecy too of the last day events. Now in early writings, page 269, we have a chapter called The Shaking. And this chapter is quite striking in the way in which it repeats, again giving us, of course, different details, the experience of the 10 virgins. Now I'll read the chapter through bit by bit, and we'll begin to comment on it and study it as we move right along. It begins on page 269 with these words, I saw some with strong faith and agonizing cries pleading with God. Their countenances were pale and marked with deep anxiety, expressive of their internal struggle. Firmness and great earnestness was expressed in their countenances. Large drops of perspiration fell from their foreheads. Now and then their faces would light up with the marks of God's approbation, and again the same solemn, earnest, anxious look would settle upon them. Evil angels crowded around, pressing darkness upon them to shut out Jesus from their view, that their eyes might be drawn to the darkness that surrounded them, and thus they be led to distrust God and murmur against him. Their only safety was in keeping their eyes directed upward. Angels of God had charge over his people, and as the poisonous atmosphere of evil angels was pressed around these anxious ones, the heavenly angels were continually wafting their wings over them to scatter the thick darkness. As the praying ones continued their earnest cries, at times a ray of light from Jesus came to them to encourage their hearts and light up their countenances. Some, I saw, did not participate in this work of agonizing and pleading. They seemed indifferent and careless. They were not resisting the darkness around them and shut them in like a thick cloud. The angels of God left these and went to the aid of the earnest praying ones. I saw angels of God hasten to the assistance of all who were struggling with all their power to resist the evil angels and trying to help themselves by calling upon God with perseverance. But his angels left those who made no effort to help themselves, and I lost sight of them. Now I want to comment now on the construction of this chapter, which is very important. This chapter is built on the following system. First of all, Sister White was shown a scene. Then next of all, she was shown what caused the particular situation which she's just been viewing. Then she's shown a second scene, and then she's shown again the implications of that right on down to the end. And we're going to go back to the Matthew 25 study we had last night and start off from the same place with a company in which there are two classes of people. I'll divide now this company like this, and we'll call one half of them the earnest, anxious ones, and the other part of them the careless and the indifferent. There it is. Now let's spend a few moments studying the attitude of these two groups of people. Now the earnest ones were the ones who were very deeply concerned over their soul salvation. Very deeply concerned. Just let's read some of those words again where it says, I saw some with strong faith and agonizing cries pleading with God. Their countenances were pale and marked with deep anxiety, expressive of their internal struggle. Firmness and great earnestness was expressed in their countenances. Large drops of perspiration fell from their foreheads. Now and then their faces would light up with the marks of God's approbation, and again the same solemn, earnest, anxious look would settle upon them. Very good. And the evil angels were there to cast darkness over them. Now, then she says, some I saw did not participate in this work of agonizing and pleading. They seemed indifferent and careless. They were not resisting the darkness around them, and it shut them in like a thick cloud. The angels of God left these and went to the aid of the earnest praying ones. I saw angels of God hasten to the assistance of all who were struggling with all their power to resist the evil angels and trying to help themselves by calling upon God with perseverance. But his angels left those who made no effort to help themselves, and I lost sight of them. So what happened to these? She says, I lost sight of them. Now, if she could say, I lost sight of them, then do they ever again appear in the vision? Never. Now, the next point is this. What caused this division in the church? Because the company, of course, symbolizes the church, in which one group is earnestly, anxiously seeking for something better, and the other group, of course, couldn't care less about it. Here comes the answer. I asked the meaning of the shaking I had seen, and was shown that it would be caused by the straight testimony called forth by the counsel of the true witness to the Laodiceans. Very good then. So the thing then which causes the shaking in this respect is the Laodicean message. So let's draw that again now. The Laodicean message then comes and is presented to the church. And when that message is presented, it causes this shaking in the church of God. Let's read that. This will have its effect upon the heart of the receiver and will lead him to exalt the standard and pour forth the straight truth. Some will not bear this straight testimony. They will rise up against it, and this is what will cause a shaking amongst God's people. Now at this point, having established the fact that this shaking in the church is called the Laodicean message, we have to ask ourselves the question, what is the Laodicean message? Well, let's turn to Revelation chapter 3, shall we, for a moment, and read the exact words of the Bible in this connection. And let's clear up from our minds forever some of the sad misconceptions that many people have in regard to the Laodicean message. Now we come to verse 14, begin to read there where it says, and unto the angel of the church of the Laodiceans write, these things saith the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. I know thy works, that thou art neither cold nor hot. I would thou wert cold or hot. So then, because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth. Because thou sayest, I am rich and increased with goods and have needed nothing, and knowest not that thou art wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. Now that's exactly where, at that point, most people who claim to preach the Laodicean message stop at that point. They go around and they declare to the church that they're wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. They tell the church that they're wrong on this and that and the other thing, and their whole doctrine and their whole message is a condemnation of every practice that is going on in the church. But this is not the preaching of the Laodicean message. The message goes on to say in verse 18, I counsel thee to buy of me gold tried in the fire, that thou mayest be rich, and white raiment that thou mayest be clothed, and that the shame of thy nakedness do not appear, and anoint thine eyes with eye salve that thou mayest see. So here's a marvelous offering that God presents to his people, gold, white raiment, and eye salve. Now, so we gain the truth of the fact that simply denouncing sin is not preaching the Laodicean message. Let's go back a moment to a comment made by A.T. Jones in his book, Lessons from the Reformation. Now, he said that for 500 years before there was a Reformation, and the Reformation began, of course, in 1300 with Wycliffe, and about 1364, as best historians can establish. Now, for 500 years before that, which takes us clear back to the 9th century, 800 and thereabout, Jones points out that there was no shortage of men who saw the iniquities of the Roman system. No shortage. And these men included priests, lay people, bishops, kings, princes, barons, and even some of the popes themselves. And these men rose up within the church, man after man, and they denounced the wrongs in the church. But Not one of those men on their own or all of them put together began a reformation or caused a shaking in the Roman Church. Not even the great Emperor Sigismund, who called that Council of Constance in the early part of the 15th century, when Huss and Jerome were condemned, and when three popes were deposed and a new one was put upon the throne of Rome, not even that man who called then for reformation succeeded in bringing about a reformation, because all those men could do was to denounce the wrongs in the church. They could not and they did not bring a gospel which would cure those wrongs. And you can be sure, if you look back through the past history of the Adventist church, you've seen man after man rise up in Adventism, even General Conference presidents and so forth, and those men have soundly condemned the conditions in the church and bewailed the spiritual destitution. You've heard them, haven't you? And I smile just to myself a little when there rises up some man at the present time in the General Conference or likewise and comes out here and he begins to really talk in bold terms about how far the church has slipped from its original standard and how we must revive and reform and get back on the mark again. I'll never forget down in Australia a few years ago, a missionary came back from India. His name was Dave Downs. He was a student at college when I was there. He came back and went up and down New South Wales and Victoria and southern Queensland preaching some very, very straight and stirring sermons. And some folks said, well, now there's a man that's going to take up the message of righteousness. But you know something? That man preached sermons just as denunciatory of the message of righteousness too. Just as denunciatory. And he went back to his mission station, and he's there still as far as I know, and after he'd gone, the churches were just the same. There was no difference, there was no shaking, there was nothing. Some folk were stirred by it, but mostly, of course, folk dropped back into their old lethargy after he'd passed on his way back to his mission station. In other words, any message which comes along and does not offer to the people in the Laodicean condition gold, white raiment, and eye salve is not the Laodicean message. That should be clear, shouldn't it? Anything which doesn't offer that is not the Laodicean message. Now, true, exposure of sin is a part of the message. As I said before, the most effective way to expose sin is to preach righteousness. And by contrast, you're going to see the difference between the good and the evil, and you're going to want the better if you have any kind of spiritual response at all. Now, let's go back a moment to the 1888 message, and I want you to see how the 1888 message and the Laodicean message are one and the same thing. And this is extremely important in this study, of course. Now, let's write down here, first of all, the Laodicean message. And the Laodicean message offers, first of all, the gold, next of all, the white raiment, and last of all, the eye salve. Now, what does the gold represent? Right, faith and love. So, in one word, we're putting it in one word, faith. Faith and love. The raiment? Good. Righteousness of Christ, which is the character of Christ, the life of Christ, and the eye salve? Right, spiritual discernment or spiritual vision. I'll use the short word there for space. I'm short of space. Now, let's look at the 1888 message. It says, page 91 and 2 in Testimonies to Ministers. The Lord, in His great mercy, sent a most precious message to His people through Elders Wagoner and Jones. This message was to bring more prominently before the world the uplifted Savior, the sacrifice for the sins of the whole world. It presented justification through faith in the surety. It invited the people to receive the righteousness of Christ, which is made manifest in obedience to all the commandments of God. Many had lost sight of Jesus. They needed to have their eyes directed to His divine person, His merits, and His changeless love for the human family. Let's go back over this now and just pick up the thoughts were given. The first thing it says, it presented justification through faith in the surety. That's the first thing that the 1888 message offered the people of God. All right then, is that not the gold? Justification by faith in the surety? Why, certainly. So I'll put down here now Here we have the 1888, and back here, of course, we have the Laodicean message. And the 1888 message offered justification by faith in the surety. And next of all, it says, it invited the people to receive the righteousness of Christ, which is made manifest in obedience to all the commandments of God. And so there we have obedience comes next, or righteousness. There it is. And last of all, it says, many had lost sight of Jesus. They needed to have their eyes directed to his divine person, his merits, and his changeless love for the human family. So last of all, we have sight as being given to those folk back in 1888. And note how the same order is given in the Laodicean message, and the same order is given in the 1888 message. So what are they? One and the same message. Did the 1888 message condemn the lukewarmness and coldness of the church of that day? Why, certainly it did. That's why they rose up against it at that time. And then Sister White goes on to say, this is the message that God commanded to be given to the world. It is the third angel's message, which is to be proclaimed with a loud voice and attended with the outpouring of his Spirit in a large measure. Now, can you see then that the 1888 message is the Laodicean message in the clearest of possible terms? There it is. All right then. Now, here we have a prophecy in early writings about a future time when the Laodicean message would create a great shaking in the Church of God. Good. Now, back in 1888, of course, it began to do that. But as you know, the message was cut off, and therefore the shaking became incomplete and the church settled down again. But what was the prophecy that was made by Sister White back at that time? The fourth angel had come down, but he'd gone back, but what would he do again? He would? Right, he will return. And when did he return with that message again? Good, 1950. Now can you see how perfectly this ties in with the Ten Virgins study? And adds evidence to evidence to prove that date 1950 as the beginning of the return of that great message. First of all, of course, it came dimly, but it came with increasing clarity as time has gone on. Now, when that message came, did it create in the Seventh-day Adventist Church those two classes of people? Why, certainly. It created those who were earnest and anxious about their soul salvation. It created those, well, it brought out those who were careless and indifferent. And as Matthew 22 says, they made light of it and went their ways, one to his farm and another to his merchandise. Now then, some folks say to me, well, where have we seen this kind of agonizing that you read about here in early writings, where people are agonizing and they're pale and drops of perspiration are on their brow and so forth? Where have you seen that? That's right. Now I could tell you that I could lead you to people who were so bowed down with the burden of their sins during the 50s that some of them even went so far as to contemplate suicide. That's how black things came upon some people during that period of agonizing. Now, true, not all of us have gone to that depth of agonizing, but there have been many who have around the world field. And this was an extremely serious matter in their minds as they went through that harrowing Romans 7 experience, pleading, pleading, pleading for victory. I think some of you folk could testify to a long, dark period when you were searching and hungering for something better, and the words of this paragraph describe pretty well the experience through which you passed. Isn't that true?
Definitely so.
Uh-huh. Now, of course, the skeptical ones who don't believe this are folk who didn't have the agonizing experience, and they're looking in from the outside. They never had it themselves. And, of course, people who have this kind of experience don't go up and down the streets displaying it. It's something which is internal, is far out on your knees in the secret of your own bedrooms and closets and so forth, where no human eye can see. Now, remember in Matthew 22, we showed how the Seventh-day Adventist Church came to the place where they were completely outside of the picture so far as God's truth is concerned. And note how Sister White says here, I lost sight of the careless and the indifferent ones. So what's she saying about that class of people? They don't appear anymore in the picture. Right? We look elsewhere now for the true stream as we go along. Now I want to read on now a little further. And well, first of all, remember in the parable of the ten virgins, we saw this company go on a little further. And then we saw, moving out from them, the company of wise and foolish virgins who made the true church of God up here, and here were the wise and here were the foolish. And they came along with their first disappointment, and the foolish then returned back to the church from which they had come. That is, the woman with the dead child, or the dead message, went back to join with the enemies of God's people. Then we find that this little company progressed along here, and there was given to them light and more light. And as we saw in the 2 days of opportunity, these people have three great gifts. What are they? What's the first one? Good victory. What's the second one?
Unity.
Right. And the third one? Now, you're going to see that all three of these characteristics are brought to view in the next picture Sister White saw here in this chapter in early writings. Pardon? I did. Yeah, I repeated them on the board. First of all, I should read this paragraph there before I'm just a little bit ahead of myself. I saw the testimony of the true witness has not been half heeded. The solemn testimony upon which the destiny of the church hangs has been lightly esteemed, if not entirely disregarded. This testimony must work deep repentance. All who receive it will obey it and be purified. Very good. Now, all who receive it will obey it and what? Be purified. Is that true? How do you know? By experience. That's right, isn't it? But come back a moment where it says, the solemn testimony upon which the destiny of the church hangs. In other words, the way in which the church received that message depends upon her future destiny. And everyone who rejected it, as this prophecy plainly shows, what does Sister White say? I lost sight of them. Whereas those who accept it, they go on as God's church. So the destiny of the church does not hang upon the death decree, which is a far distant thing in the future. The destiny of the church hangs upon the way in which this message is accepted. Now let me ask you this question. Is that telling you the same truth as Matthew 22 told you about the second call? The same, isn't it? Not a scrap of difference. The same message, the same consistent, harmonious truth runs through every one of these prophecies. Now we come to the second scene in early writings, 270 and 271. It said, the angel, list ye, or listen. Soon I heard a voice like many musical instruments, all sounding in perfect strains, sweet and harmonious. Now give me one word for that. Unity. Good, unity. And of course, anybody who's played in an orchestra knows that the instruments must all be in perfect tune and in perfect time and playing the same musical score if there's going to be harmony and unity. If this musician over here wants to play his violin out of tune with this one over here, and he wants to play one tune and this man plays another tune, what have you got? A discord, haven't you? The worst kind of discord. It surpassed any music I had ever heard, seeming to be full of mercy, compassion, and elevating holy joy. It thrilled through my whole being. Said the angel, look ye. My attention was then turned to the company I had seen, who were mightily shaken. I was shown those whom I had before seen weeping and praying in agony of spirit. Now, alright, let's just really get this in our minds as we go along and study it carefully. Her attention was turned back to this company which had been shaken, and then she said, I was shown those whom I had before seen weeping and praying in agony of spirit. And that's this company here, the earnest and anxious ones, right? That's this company. Now you listen to this. This is very precious to me. Some folks say, why aren't you afraid to fly around the world and travel to heathen lands like Africa and so forth? Here's why. It tells me the company of guardian angels around them had been doubled. Isn't that nice to know? Remember that back in the previous study we read that one angel was keeping faithful watch over every earnest one when we were back in the church. But now we have come out of the church, we no longer have one, we have what? Two. And that's better than one. One's enough, you know, but two's a lot better. So we read there that the company of guardian angels around them had been doubled, and they were clothed with an armor from their head to their feet. And what is the armor? Absolutely. It's the righteousness of Jesus Christ. And that, of course, in one word is victory. They moved in exact order like a company of soldiers. If there's one thing which strikes me in regard to this movement, is the fact that although we're divided by thousands upon thousands of miles, and we don't get together very often in any kind of a large group, and nobody in the whole group around the world is a president or a director or a manager over anybody else, and of all the people that think in the world that think for themselves, well, this group does, and you believe what you believe because that's what you yourself have come to, and yet all around the world we just move as one. Isn't that true? It's a miracle of God's power amongst the people. And this word is exactly true of our experience. They moved in exact order like a company of soldiers. When I go to Africa, it's the same. When I go to Europe, it's the same. When I go to Scandinavia, it's the same. Australia and America, it's the same. Wherever I go, I don't have to alter my way of life or my thinking or my activities in the least degree to fit in with any other believer, because we all think the same and move just as one around the entire world. And that is unity. Their countenances expressed the severe conflict which they had endured, the agonizing struggle they had passed through. Yet their features, marked with severe internal anguish, now shone with the light and glory of heaven. Now listen, they had obtained the victory, and it called forth from them the deepest gratitude and holy sacred joy. And doesn't it? Why, surely it does. And this doesn't look forward to a great victory to be gained in the future, although of course we do gain the victory of the beast in his image in the future, but this is speaking of the internal victory over sin. So now here we have a company of believers. So far we see that they have victory and they have unity. Implicit, of course, in that paragraph is separation, which comes clearer in the next paragraph. Now, in one simple sentence, it points back to the shaking which takes place here. By the way, I should mention that the picture we're given here now is a picture of the believers up here. That is, just before the loud cry period. The first picture is back here before the separation. The second picture is here up here after the separation. Now, as he says, the numbers of this company had lessened. Some had been shaken out and left by the way. The careless and indifferent, who did not join with those who prized victory and salvation enough to perseveringly plead and agonize for it, did not obtain it, and they were left behind in darkness, and their places were immediately filled by others taking hold of the truth and coming into the ranks. There's a wealth of truth in that sentence, and we'll need to spend some time discussing it right now. Now notice that it says here, some have been shaken out and left by the way. Some of this original company. Now, as we learned previously, of course, those who came out were wise and foolish virgins. And remember this, that the foolish virgin at first does participate with the wise in their anxiety to come out and follow their Lord wherever he goes. But remember this, that the foolish virgin does not go on providing himself with the oil. In their carelessness, in her carelessness, the mother overlaid her baby and smothered it, as you saw in this morning's study. And so when the test comes, they are found to have a superficial experience that only went so far but did not go deep enough. How beautifully that's portrayed here. The careless and the indifferent. Not this careless and indifferent down here, who didn't go after the thing at all, but this group here who became careless and indifferent in their self-confidence, who did not join with those who prized victory and salvation enough to perseveringly plead and agonize for it. And that doesn't infer, if they did not perseveringly plead, that they did plead so far, superficially, but didn't go all the way, and not going all the way, they failed to get it, And they were left behind in darkness, and their places were filled by others taking hold of the truth and coming into the ranks. Now right here now we have the statement which I promised to draw your attention to as we progressed along here. Now, when all the Brinsmeads went back to the church again, they left a tremendous hole in the ranks of the awakening. And only a very, very few were left. Too few to finish the work around the world. Too few to begin the great loud cry message. God needs to have, in these last days, people all over the world. Some in America, some in Canada, some in Australia, New Zealand, Europe, Africa, Asia, and South America. So when the loud cry breaks, he's got little outposts of truth everywhere that can spread the light right where they are and carry the message in their own area. So there are too few down there in Australia at the end of 63 to do that. But here we find that the places of those who have fallen out are taken by others laying hold of the truth and coming into the ranks, and this is still before the loud cry period. And I would say that most of the people in this room find themselves coming to the picture at this point. Isn't that true? This is where you come in, and you're taking the place of others who are shaken out and left by the way. Now, I love this prophecy so much because it so clearly and plainly shows the position occupied by everybody involved at the present time in this drama. Now, see where the Brinsmeads come in? Well, there they were, filled these virgins, and went so far and fell out again. When I see where the church is, they're lost sight of. Out of the picture altogether. Not God's truth in any sense of the word. Do you want to know where those of us have been in this from the beginning? Well, we're right back here and we came right through and here we are still. This is where I came in from the very beginning. I've been in this thing from its inception, right through all those battles and still with it to the present time. Others of you can see yourselves coming in now and taking the places of others who have been left out and fallen by the way. What about the people in the church who are still hungry and earnest? They're the hidden ones down here in the apostate system. And so you have everybody taken care of, don't you? The prophecy is a revelation of the position that everybody at the present time occupies, and with all that kind of light, what excuse can we have if we take the wrong position? None at all, can we? None whatsoever. Now, let's take the next thought, and that is separation. It says, the careless and indifferent who did not join with those who prized victory and salvation enough to perseveringly plead and agonize for it, did not obtain it, and they were left behind in darkness, and their places were immediately filled by others taking hold of the truth and coming into the ranks. Now what does that expression convey to your mind? Coming into the ranks. Separation? Why, surely. Because those who... It means that those who are in the churches and gain the truth and lay hold upon it come out of that position and come into the ranks of God's people. It means they come from one place to another place. And how could they do that if the other place wasn't separate from the original place? They couldn't possibly. So there's scene number two. Now we come to the next glorious scene, the loud cry. I heard those clothed with the armor speak forth the truth with great power. It had effect. Many had been bound, some wives by their husbands, and some children by their parents. The honest who had been prevented from hearing the truth now eagerly laid hold upon it. All fear of their relatives was gone, and the truth alone was exalted to them. They had been hungering and thirsting for truth. It was dearer and more precious than life. I asked what had made this great change. An angel answered, it is the latter rain, the refreshing from the presence of the Lord, the loud cry of the third angel. Now, Brinsmead has been very dishonest with this particular statement. In one of their publications, I've just forgotten its name now, but it's not too hard to find. It's one that came out about 2 years ago, I think. It was one of those, it was a little brown book. About the size of an early writings. No, it wasn't one of those. It was a bit bigger than that. It wasn't that one either. No, a bit bigger than that one, about the size of early writings. Anyway, it's one of the Nature of Men, I think it was. Now, in this, they go back and they quote the paragraph where it says that they moved in exact order like a company of soldiers and so forth. Then they miss out that part about the relatives and friends. and miss it right out. And then comes the question, I ask what made this great change, the latter rain. So in their quotation they paint the agonizing picture, then they paint the victory picture, miss out the next poem altogether, then raise the question, what made this great change, the latter rain? Which is not what the statement says at all. The statement says, many had been bound, some wives by their husbands, and some children by their parents. Now there's one picture, isn't it? A situation. The honest, who had been prevented from hearing the truth, now eagerly laid hold upon it. All fear of their relatives was gone, and the truth alone was exalted to them. They had been hungering and thirsting for truth. It was dearer and more precious than life. Now there's the picture of a change from fear and bondage into liberty and the eager grasping of this truth. Now the very next words say, I ask what made this great change. What was the change? In the reception of the message by the hidden ones still locked in the fallen churches. Isn't that the change? Now what made the difference? The latter rain, the refreshing from the presence of the Lord, the loud cry of the third angel. Now I want now, and if you can gain the true force of these two paragraphs from Great Controversy, page 373, in the early writings, page 271, we'll find here that they tell the same story. Now in Great Controversy 373, remember we read, angels of God were watching with the deepest interest the result of the warning. And here comes the warning. When there was a general rejection of the message in the part of the churches, or by the churches, angels turned away in sadness. But there are many who had not yet been tested in regard to the Advent truth. Many were misled by husbands, wives, parents or children, and were made to believe it a sin even to listen to such heresies as were taught by the Adventists. Angels were bidden to keep faithful watch over these souls, for another light was yet to shine upon them from the throne of God. Now in Great Controversy you have the picture of these folk being bound. Until that light should come, in early writings you have the beautiful picture of them being set free. You've just got that paragraph in mind, let's compare it now with this one again. Many had been bound, some wives by their husbands, and some children by their parents. That's how it reads in early writings. Remember back in Great Controversy it said, many were misled by husbands, wives, parents, or children, and were made to believe it a sin even to listen to such heresies that were taught by the Adventists. Very good. But that bondage and that blindness will continue only until the loud cry begins. And then will come that setting free of these bound individuals as they gladly receive the glorious light of the loud cry message. Remember that last night in our study of the order of last day events from the ten virgins, we found that next of all there came what at this point? The midnight cry. Correct? And that message went down into the fallen churches and reached the hidden ones down there who had not been reached before. And what happened? As the cry went forth, come out of her, my people, they came out to join with those who had previously gained their freedom. And there is the same picture exactly painted here in the book Early Writings. I'm going to stop at this point because it goes on then to deal with things that are more or less order of last day events. Great powers were these chosen ones, said the angel, look ye, my attention was turned to the wicked or unbelievers, they were all astir. So then comes persecution, then comes Jacob's trouble, then comes the second coming of Jesus Christ. We're not concerned so much with the detailed history of that just now, we're concerned with the vindication of this movement as a separate movement from the church, and this chapter in early writings paints an identical picture with Matthew 25 and with Matthew 22. There it is in the clearest of terms. Just rehearsing the main vital points again, this prophecy in early writings points forward to that time when the true Laodicean message, or the 1888 message, would come again in power to the Seventh-day Adventist Church and produce the two classes, the earnest and anxious ones, the careless and the indifferent. That took place back in 1950. As a result, the destiny of the church was determined by their attitude, and Sister White says, I lost sight of them. But the wise and foolish went out to follow their Lord, but the foolish went back to the church again, but their places have been taken up by others coming into the ranks who are being prepared to receive the latter rain and to give the message in power in turn to the churches. And the picture painted today in the very shadow of the loud cry is one of victory personally over sin, unity amongst ourselves, and separation from the church organization. This is where we stand today. And the very next event, once again in this prophecy, is the coming of the latter rain. It can't be too far away, and I trust that each one of us will be ready for it when it does come, finding our place amongst God's true remnant, to receive that power, to give that message, to finish the work, and have the joy of meeting up in the camp meeting in heaven.